This podcast episode is powered by AfriPods, the world's number one podcasting platform for African stories.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Startup Show, hosted by the Kenyan Wall Street. My name is Ali Mwakaneno Gakweli, your usual host, and today we're sitting with Yoel Haile, who is the founder and CEO of Wine Life, which offers a lifestyle experience of wine. I think Yoel is in a better position to describe what they do here. And we want to talk about, you know, his experience in scaling a startup in Africa, going back to his story, early in Merrill Lynch to Aspira to now Wine Life, and what are some of the things that he's picked up throughout the journey, and where he wants to take Wine Life, and generally discuss other things that affect startups in the continent, such as regulation and how best they can raise funds. Welcome to the show, Yoel.
Welcome, and thanks for having me today.
All right, Yoel. So before we get to know what you've done in your career, why in Africa, man? You left the United States and then went to China and then in Africa. What's up?
Yeah. So I guess a little about myself. So I'm an Eritrean American. So I was born and raised in the US, but I always had close ties to the continent and a strong sense of nationality and pride in our country. And have been visiting Eritrea since we got our independence and going every few years and visiting family there. I think if I look at my career journey, I think when I was at Merrill Lynch, I was able to spend 2 years working in Hong Kong and really do a lot of traveling around Southeast Asia. And it really opened up my eyes to the potential in emerging markets and growing economies. So, after I left Merrill Lynch and went back to business school, I was in business school for 2 years and I did my internship in the US. And I realized that, the U.S. doesn't make sense for me professionally. I decided to focus my second year on finding opportunities on the continent. Mm-hmm. And being able to move here and create impact and do work and, hopefully eventually even be able to do a few projects in Eritrea.
So for my new listeners, if you don't know Yoel yet, so Yoel started out his career in GE actually back in 2007, is that right?
Yeah. So my background was in engineering. So when I was an undergrad, I spent some time at GE working on steam and gas turbines, spending a lot of time in factories. And my background is as an industrial engineer. So a lot of my classmates ended up going into those types of fields where they're helping to companies, become more efficient and design their supply chains. I always had a passion for the stock market, so decided to do something a little bit different and applied to one bank and applied to work in Merrill Lynch and made it through the interview process and they offered me a job. This was back in 2008, so right in the middle of the financial crisis, got the opportunity to join the firm and I had a good 4 years working there and that was kind of my first foray into the finance sector. I've stayed mostly in the finance sector since then. Spent a lot of time in the fintech space here in Kenya. I started a company called Aspira,
right,
which is a buy now, pay later, digital hire purchase company. Mm-hmm. So spent 3 years running that and building up the business before more recently jumping into the lifestyle space and starting Wine Life.
So you, of course, this is your second startup in Kenya. So Aspira and then Wine Life. What has been your experience, trying to scale up a startup in Kenya and maybe in Africa in general?
Yeah. So my experience is it is very difficult to scale up businesses here in on the continent. So I've been lucky to be able to do that in three different industries. And I think there's a lot of the same core tenants, regardless of what industry you're in, right? So, I spent 2.5 years at ALU, so I got some experience in the education space in terms of, how it is to work in the education startup space. And we opened up 2 campuses in Mauritius and Rwanda, and, got to see the ease of doing business in both markets, as well as, how difficult it was to do, a pan-African business based in South Africa. And one of the challenges that we had at the time was getting student visas and work visas for our staff and the students. And that's why it didn't make sense to set up our business in South Africa. So we did a lot of research and identified Mauritius and Rwanda as two countries where it's quite easy to get your assets, your human resources to that country. And eventually we opened up campuses in both countries. Going to Aspira, we also did market research and identified a few markets that make sense to, launch a digital financial service product, right? And I think if you look at a lot of fintech organizations that are setting up, they identify Kenya as a prime place to set up this type of business because, your consumer is naturally comfortable using financial services on their phone. And M-Pesa and a lot of these lending apps have been able to build that, awareness and making consumers comfortable with that over the last 10, 15 years. So if you look at the fintech space, Kenya makes a lot of sense because, you don't have to open physical branches all over the place. You have that infrastructure in terms of small phone penetration, and then you're just being comfortable using financial services on the phone, more so than most countries around the world, right? So, Kenya's a great hub for, any new fintech to try to test out new concepts because your user base is very comfortable with, using mobile phones for digital financial services. And then now moving into, Wine Life, one thing that was attractive about this market was, you have a good sized population that has spending power, mm-hmm. and you have very low penetration in terms of wine consumption, especially compared to other countries in the region. I think if you're looking at a business, it's important to do your market research and find out, is this a place where I can set up and operate, right? So, if I'm looking at the education sector, South Africa is a very difficult place to set up. Whereas, Mauritius and Rwanda were countries where you were able to get accreditation and approvals and then also get your assets and resources there. If I look at the fintech space, Kenya is a very easy place to set up and get running as a fintech business. There are other challenges, especially if you're doing lending in terms of, what are the controls and measures you can take to recover the money that you've lent, right? So I would say Kenya is a place where, that legal system and those structures haven't been developed as much as other markets. So if you're doing unsecured lending, mm-hmm. it can be very risky if your credit model isn't designed properly.
Can you delve a little bit better into what other markets are doing to just make sure that companies get their money back? Because I believe that Kenyan fintech is already expanding to other African countries.
So when we looked at lending at Aspira, there's two things when you're looking at a consumer. So you look at your consumer and identify, okay, this is someone who's able to repay X amount of dollars per month. Mm-hmm. And this is their probability of default, using credit scores and other data points. But ultimately, at the end of the day, once you've lent to a customer, there's ability to repay and willingness to repay. So when we're looking at markets, Rwanda was actually quite attractive because there's a strong willingness to repay your loans and really stay on top of your debt. At the same time, Rwanda is a very small market compared to Kenya and Uganda and some of the other countries in this region. So we decided to focus on Kenya initially, knowing that if we can prove that there's product market fit, it's very easy now to go to Rwanda, especially looking at some of the retail partners that we have. A lot of them have operations in Uganda and Rwanda. I think Kenya, in terms of fintech, there's a large pool of consumers who are very comfortable, accessing loans or financial services from their phone. And there's a lot of data out there to give you as a fintech company a better understanding of what are the risks for an individual. And that's been built up by all the companies who've been lending here from the past 10 years, right? They've learned, they've helped build up the accuracy of the credit score. So now, if you're coming in as a fintech lender in this space, I found credit score to be very predictive in terms of sloping, you know, the probability of default for a certain credit score versus the reality. You know, it was pretty much right on the dot, you know, in terms of the credit bureaus that we've worked with. Now, on top of that, you can build other layers of protection.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ultimately, depending on what type of lending you're doing, you have to know at the end of the day, it might be difficult to recover from a non-performing loan, or it might be too expensive to go and try to recover on that loan, right? So the biggest product that we would finance was mobile phones, right? So if you look at a mobile phone and, you know, within 6 months, you know, the screen will probably be cracked, the model will be out of date. So that value of that phone is, you know, worth less than half.
It depreciates really quickly.
Exactly, exactly. So if you look at someone who's, you know, not repaying their loan, and the value of that asset and then the cost to recover that asset and trying to even track down that customer, you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense. So what you find is a lot of companies actually outsource their collections. And, you know, even that regular follow-up with their customer base. And, you know, ultimately they're looking at, you know, what is your core business, right? And your core business is being able to screen and evaluate customers. So when we were building Aspira, we did an exercise where, you know, we identified what are the core functions of the organization that we want to keep in-house versus what we want to outsource, right? So we outsourced things like collections, we outsourced our sales agents and the management of the sales agents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's a lot of businesses out there whose expertise and focus is that, right? Or even our call center was another function that we outsourced. And, you know, sometimes as a business, it might be slightly more expensive to outsource rather than build it in-house. But, you know, going back to, you know, what is it that is your core business and your core capability? And you want to focus on that and, you know, keep your team lean and focus on that. So even the first year when we were building Aspira, you know, it took us about a year to go to market from when we first set up the company. You know, we had a team of four. And, the, you know, I think the lesson from there is as a startup, you know, you don't need to have a massive team and massive overheads to be able to build a product and go to market. You know, you can outsource certain functions. You know, we outsource our tech development initially, and then we brought it in-house once we went to market. And the benefit of that was that, you know, we didn't have to manage a tech team in-house, which wasn't our core expertise and our core focus. Our core focus was understanding if there's product market fit, doing pilots, onboarding the right partners who will be able to help us build our brand awareness and grow our loan book. So we focused on that, outsourced all the other key functions, and then we were able to you know, take our business to market with just a team of four people.
But then there's the fact that a couple of startups I've interacted with tend to pivot.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle, you know, the pivoting with when most of your services are outsourced?
So my experience at startups has been, you know, taking a very agile and lean approach, right? So if you're developing a tech product, right? So if I look at how we did our initial development at Aspira and how we've kind of looked at things at Winelife as well. And, you know, you test out a lot of different concepts. You know, to give an example, you know, with Winelife, we've done a lot of different partnerships with different bars and hotels and restaurants and golf clubs to get a better understanding of different neighborhoods, right? Because if you're looking at the hospitality space and you're going to have physical assets in terms of your locations, it costs a lot of money to set up a new branch somewhere, right? So, you know, you want to be in the right neighborhoods where there's a core target market that, you know, will come and enjoy your services, right? So, you know, when we set up our first location in Erie and we're looking for additional locations, you know, a lot of people were asking us to, you know, consider Karen and Lavington and all these places, but, you know, rather than just going and finding a location and opening up and then realizing that there's no product market fit, what we did is we actually did pop-ups with other bars, right? And, you know, people might look at it and say, you know, why would you go to another establishment, which is a competitor, but, you know, it's not necessarily a winner-take-all market, right? And, you know, there's a benefit to both sides, right? So we have some good relationships with some other establishments here in Nairobi. And you know, we were able to push some of our core target market to come to our events there, and you know, vice versa, you know, being able to access their core customer base and tell them about what we're doing at our other branch. The whole time, you know, us taking the financial risk and doing a profit share in terms of like the wine tasting that we've done on the road.
Right.
So that's given us a lot of insights about where, you know, we should be opening and what makes sense for our model. You know, which led us to opening our second location outside of Nairobi. You know, we felt that there's a bigger opportunity in this space outside of Nairobi. So, you know, we have our core kind of first location here in Kigiri. But, you know, we've been really focused on opportunities outside of Nairobi, right? So, and looking at, you know, going back to, you know, who is your target market, right? And if you're looking at wine, your target market is, you know, there's tourists, there's expats, there's middle to upper class Kenyans. And what do all these people have in common is that, you know, they're not always in Nairobi, right? So look at what destinations that people travel to. Naivasha and Nakuru are popular weekend getaways. And you know, there's a road that goes to those cities, right? And on that road, there's a very beautiful place called the Viewpoint. We have a beautiful view of the Rift Valley, you know, which is a UN World Heritage Site, and it's probably one of the busier roads in Kenya. And you know, personally, you know, it's a place where I would enjoy stopping on my travels on that road, and you know, I would always wonder, you know, how can someone's not build something here targeting these consumers, right? And you know, ultimately decided to take a risk, you know, invested some capital and got a container, got our licensing and permits and plopped a container down there. And you know, the hypothesis was, you know, people would stop here on the way, you know, to Naivasha, on the way back to Nairobi, and hopefully pick up some bottles of wine to take with them for the weekend, or enjoy some wines there and enjoy the you know, the beautiful view. You know, so it was, you know, a low risk pilot, I would say, because ultimately if it didn't work out, you know, you have an asset that you can move to another location or sell in terms of the back container. And you know, what we found, you know, a couple months in is that, you know, there's huge potential in terms of profitability of that model. And you know, so it's been going well. It's been about 7 months since we opened that branch. It's actually more profitable than our main branch here in Nairobi.
Wow.
So you know, when I just stepped back, you know, and looked at the model of what we've done there in terms of how much cost it took us to set up and the period of time to recover on your investment, I'd much rather focus on other opportunities like that, whether it's in Kenya or in other markets, and then as opposed to taking significant upfront capital and investment to open and then another location in Nairobi where you have hundreds of competitors.
I feel like you've talked about Wine Life, but then it might be new to our listeners. Tell us about what does Wine Life do and what's the story behind the company?
Sure. So, you know, so me and so my business partner, you know, has some background in terms of being a private chef and also selling wine. I'm a fan of wine, not an expert by any means, but I think one thing that was a big gap for me living in Kenya was it was very difficult to find good wine. And when you go out to certain places, it's tough to find places that serve wine at the right temperature or staff who are able to articulate and be able to sell wine. And for people who are wine drinkers, to not be able to find that anywhere, you move on now to other products in terms of, you know, whether it's spirits or beers. Now, in terms of consumers who are new to wine, maybe they get exposed to certain brands of wine which are mass market and relatively low cost, but not really great quality wine. And if your first experience with wine is not a good experience in terms of taste or hangover or whatever it might be, and it could be for a variety of factors, including not serving it at the right temperature, like a red wine should be slightly chilled, for example, and the taste would be significantly different than serving it at room temperature. So small things like that, I think, have contributed to the low market penetration of wine in Kenya, as opposed to other markets with similar spending power. So, you know, our hypothesis was initially to, you know, build a, you know, e-commerce business focused on selling wine and educating consumers and helping them find the types of wines that make sense for their palates. You know, we had an opportunity to take on a physical location here in Kigiri and decided to give it a shot, you know, and if it didn't work after a few months, then we can shift back to being focused on, you know, digital and tech and those types of sales, especially with COVID and curfews and all these restrictions limiting bars and restaurants over the past year. So we opened up in September here in Kigiri. And one of the things we want to do and focus on is wine education, right? So everything from how to hold a glass of wine to what temperature of wine should you serve that, to going much deeper depending on who's in the audience and getting specific about the types of grapes and you know the stories behind different types of wines. So we did that through our signature event, which is a weekly tasting on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. Where we go through three or four wines, and it's very interactive. And we even have an MC and a DJ, and then someone who's very knowledgeable on wines. The tasting lasts about an hour,
right?
And usually we serve about 100 to 150 people. So doing a wine tasting, you know, for, you know, 5 to 10 people is difficult in itself. So imagine doing it for 100 people. So it's a very coordinated exercise and show that allows people who are new to wine as well as people who are experienced in wine to be able to enjoy wine in a very interactive and fun experience. So what is wine like at the end of the day? It's, you know, building awareness about wine in a market where awareness is low and making it, you know, interactive and a fun experience. So, you know, I believe what we are is much more than a bar or a bar with two branches or a bar with four branches. You know, so our core product offering is, you know, being able to curate and find a selection of high quality wines and designing experiences around it, that allow consumers to, you know, comfortably be able to access and learn about the wine and try different wines.
So we were having this conversation earlier with you, and one of my questions was, why Nairobi? I mean, you mentioned that in Africa we have other cities where it's easier to access human resources, for example. And when it comes to the product that you're dealing with here, in this case it's wine, we have bigger wine cities. So why Nairobi? Why not Joburg? Why not Kinshasa?
Yeah. I mean, so those are definitely markets that, you know, we definitely want to go into over time. You know, I think Nairobi happened first because, you know, we were based here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a new concept that we were trying out, right? So going back to being able to pivot and adjust your model, you know, initially we were focused on getting an e-commerce wine business in Nairobi, which, you know, we thought was an attractive space to be in and still believe it's an attractive space to be in.
How would that look like, given that, you know, I'm trying to bridge, you know, the experience versus in e-commerce. Could you break that down for me?
Yeah. So there's a couple companies that, you know, do e-commerce, you know, specifically focused on spirits here. And the ones that do well, you know, what do they succeed on? They succeed on pricing and speed to delivery to customers.
Right.
But what they don't succeed on is knowledge of the products that they're selling, right? So it's, you know, we have these 300 brands and these are the prices and we'll deliver it to you. Whereas when you look at wine, it's a much more intimate experience when you're ordering it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to give an example, in Kigiri we have about 95 different types of wine. So when a consumer comes here, it's important that your staff is able to articulate the difference between these wines. And how do you do that? You know, it's having staff that actually have consumed the wine. Right, so you look at a lot of, you know, whether it's e-commerce companies or hotels and bars and restaurants, their staff has actually not tried their products. It's very expensive to do that exercise, right? And if you look at, you know, beyond staff turnover,
mm-hmm.
You know, opening a bottle of wine and having your team try it and be educated about it, you know, it's a cost for the business. So a lot of people don't invest in that or invest in knowing how to store wine properly or, you know, have it at the right temperature. But it's those small things that is what wine drinkers appreciate. So for example, if you order a bottle of white wine on e-commerce, you expect it to come chilled, right? So it's not just about speed of delivery, it's about speed of how fast you can consume it once it arrives. So if you get a bottle of white wine at room temperature, now you have to chill it for the next 3 hours, but you want to consume it now. So it's small things like that that we do on our e-commerce side, you know, that really drive value to the consumers.
So sort of making sure that the product is ready to be consumed when it wants to be consumed, as opposed to just having the product and then letting the consumer figure out how they're going to prepare the product for consumption.
Exactly. So I would say that, and then also understanding what the customer wants, right? So, you know, the customer might come to us and say, you know, I want, you know, a semi-sweet wine or a fruitier wine. And being able to articulate, these are a few ones that we have on our menu, already puts us ahead of other players in the space. But, you know, looking beyond that, you know, how do you differentiate yourself from the experience that you're offering to customers? Taking a step back, so why are we focused on wine as opposed to spirits? You know, so as I mentioned earlier, spirits, what is the differentiator that you have as an e-commerce business? It's cost and speed of delivery. And it's, you know, more of a spontaneous purchase than wine. You know, wine is a very personal experience. It's, you know, I'm having salmon for dinner. What is the best wine that goes with it? I've had a rough week of work and, you know, I want a full-bodied red wine to unwind with by the fireplace. So, and there's much more variety, right? So if you look at whiskey, an e-commerce shop might have 5 different brands which the market knows. You know, whereas with us, you know, if you're looking for that full body red wine, you might have 10 different wines and each has their own story, and different peculiarities between the flavors, right? So it's a very personal experience. You know, so you have to have highly knowledgeable staff who are able to, you know, sell the story behind the wine as well as sell the wine. So it's much more intimate. And it requires a lot of investment in terms of training your staff and curating a selection that meets the needs of the market. So one of the things that we're also doing is collecting data on, you know, what is the type of wines that make sense in this market from different cost perspectives, from different flavors, and figuring out, you know, these are the types of wines that would be very successful in this market. And now looking at finding wines globally that would make sense to fill those gaps and needs.
Okay. Just to sort of reflect on the business that you're currently running right now, which is lifestyle, which focuses on wine and enhancing the whole wine experience versus some of the things that you were doing earlier, which is, say, FinTech and Aspira. How does the lifestyle business differ from, you know, other startups like FinTech?
Yeah. So I think one key difference between FinTech and lifestyle is, you know, in FinTech, your customer is, you know, it's a name, it's an ID number, it's something on a database. And often you don't interact directly with your customer, right? Whereas with wine, it's very different. You know, often your first point of interaction is in person, right? So it's important that you're able to articulate, you know, what is your brand is about and then be able to sell that wine and then the story behind the wine. You know, if I look at a lot of the elements of the business, you know, whether it's lifestyle, whether it's FinTech, whether it's education, you know, most businesses have the same key functions in the background, right? You need marketing, operations, finance, you know, someone who's focused on, you know, understanding your customer and getting constant feedback from them and improving your customer service, tech and IT. So, you know, when you're starting a business, you don't necessarily need to be an expert in that space, right? But, you know, do you have the right team of people who can come together and be able to deliver that service now to customers, right? So if I look at our team at Wine Life, it comes from a multi-ethnic background in hospitality. A lot of them have worked at five-star hotels, both here in Kenya and internationally. But, you know, people who come from a hospitality background might not be as strong in terms of, you know, coming up with a pricing strategy or coming up with a marketing plan to develop brand awareness, right? So, you know, if you look at, you know, why someone like me is jumping into that space, you know, I look at myself as, you know, more of a generalist, right? So, you know, having started and ran a fintech business, mm-hmm. you need to have a solid understanding of these areas. And once you do, you know, now you can go into a variety of industries, because at the end of the day, the product that you're selling is the only thing that's differing, right? So before, what was I doing at Aspira? I was giving consumers access to credits, you know, unsecured credits, quick and easy, and being a much better alternative than a bank in terms of that type of financing. And it's a very niche type of financing. What am I doing now in terms of Wine Life? I'm offering consumers access and knowledge in terms of, you know, what is wine about, and being able to deliver them products and allow them to engage with products in very interactive experiences. But at the end of the day, you know, what's behind in the business, right? It's the core strength of your back office and your operations, and being to understand what the consumer wants, being able to retain that consumer, and being able to grow awareness, right, through those consumers referring your business to other individuals, or through, you know, different marketing techniques to be able to promote your brand. So I would say that, you know, at a high level, you know, fintech and lifestyle are like very different industries, but, you know, a lot of it is actually very similar. And, you know, once you figure out the unit economics of your business and, you know, you're able to crack it, you know, that's when you now focus on how to scale a business, right? Which is, once again, a different skill set than most people in hospitality. You see, you know, when you look at a lot of leading bars and restaurants globally, you know, their focus is on one location. Because sometimes it's tough to scale what it is that that key person or that key chef is bringing to the table, right? So if I look at, you know, what is Wine Life's core tenants and what are we about and what distinguishes us, you know, it's not the food, right? You know, we offer food because it's complimentary and you know, someone who's enjoying wine, you know, want a cheese platter or a lunch or dinner with their wine. But at the end of the day, why are they coming to Wine Life in our branches and our events? It's to experience a variety of different wines, to enjoy it and be part of the community of new wine drinkers, right? So we're trying to increase market penetration of wine across East Africa and build a community of people who are learning and growing throughout it, right? So, you know, some of the things that we're investing in is, you know, designing education programs for corporates and individuals, you know, to be able to learn about wine in a safe and comfortable space that's very flexible to their schedules. And you might ask, you know, why would you invest so much in promoting awareness and all these things? But if you look at the long-term vision of the company, you know, one of the things we want to get into is, you know, owning and bringing in our own wines into the market. Mm-hmm. Of course, having a retail footprint across East Africa and being able to position those brands now. So much so that, you know, if I go to a vineyard and say, hey, you know, we're Wine Life, this is what we're about, and this is our presence across the region. As a vineyard, now you have one brand who you can work with, which is much easier than, you know, partnering four or five different importers in different countries. You know, it's a one-stop shop where, you know, you can, you know, educate consumers and introduce new wine brands to a region where market penetration is very low, but it's also growing quite quickly.
So at the moment, it's more about handling wine as a category before we get to, you know, specific products, which is where you want to take the company.
Exactly. So, you know, even if I look back at, you know, my time at Aspira, you know, we were focused on hire purchase and Hire Purchase existed in Kenya in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of went away because there wasn't enough data out there for people to be able to lend comfortably to consumers. So the businesses weren't profitable. But now, you know, over the last 5 years, there's a lot more data and credit scores are much more reliable. There's just been all these lenders in the space. So we were not just only launching in the market, but we were educating users about a new type of finance that they were not comfortable with or did not know existed at the time. So sometimes when you're entering a space where your penetration is low or you're the first mover in that market, the first step is actually educating the market about what it is that you're offering, building that trust and confidence and building up a consumer base who can go out there and be your brand ambassadors. So I think that those are two things that I found to be very similar in terms of, you know, if I look at the first year or the first 2 years when I was starting Aspira versus the first year now starting WineLife. You know, you're investing a lot in terms of educating and creating that awareness, trying to lock in that user and keep them sticky, and then expand over time, right? So, you know, with Aspira, that was, you know, expanding in terms of the retailers and products that we financed,
mm-hmm.
and expanding outside of Nairobi to Mombasa. You know, with WineLife, it's similar, right? So it's, you know, creating a different series of events and experiences to keep your consumer coming back, bringing in new products for them to try, so always keeping your menu fresh in terms of selection, and then also expanding over time, so being able to offer a certain type of experience in multiple cities and markets.
As a founder, of course, what are some of the things that you've done at WineLife that you're proud of? What are some of the little milestones that keep you going?
Yeah. So I think one thing that's great about this industry is, you know, you're able to get that feedback from customers immediately, right? So I remember there was one customer, a woman in her early 20s, who used to always come to WineLife on Thursdays with her father. And her feedback was that, you know, her father was a wine drinker and she just got into wine drinking by coming to WineLife with friends. And now she comes with her father and she's been able to build a stronger bond with her father and develop that type of connection that didn't exist before, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you look at, you know, being able to bring together communities of people, but also, you know, in terms of employment, right? So, you know, we've been able to create 25 jobs in the hospitality sector during COVID. And that's one of the toughest hit sectors, you know, due to COVID. So being able to create employment and, you know, at the end of the day, when you build a product, you know, if you look at FinTech, you build a product and, you know, you look at your dashboard and you see you've lent, you know, to 100 customers today. It's just a number on the dashboard. You know, when you do an event and you have 100 customers who are coming regularly every week and leaving, having enjoyed, you know, their experience and getting value for the money that they spent, it's also a good feeling, right? To be able to see, you know, something that, you know, didn't exist that you were able to create and then deliver value to consumers. So that's always rewarding, you know, when you're, you know, at one of your branches and you know, you can see customers engaging with your product and enjoying it and coming back and referring people to come back. It's a signal that you have found product market fit.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's about, you know, pulling the right levers to be able to grow and scale your business. You know, so a lot of people ask, you know, what is the goal of WineLife or like where are you trying to go with the business? And it's difficult to answer because I don't think there's many similar businesses to us, not just in Kenya, but globally. Like if you look at a chain of, you know, bars focused on selling wine, right? So the example I give people is Java House, right? And Java House found a niche that you might say is easy to replicate. You know, you're selling coffee and food in a cafe and you're setting up branches in different locations. But, you know, what was the key to their success, right? And the key to the success was, you know, a few different reasons, from consistency of, you know, their offerings in terms of the food and coffee, consistencies in terms of look and feel of their branches, and, you know, really investing in human resources and their people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to grow from, you know, opening a new branch every year to eventually opening a couple branches every year and, you know, now being present in multiple markets, right? So you know, if I look at where I see WineLife growing, you know, we want to kind of follow the same path, right? So, you know, been blessed to be able to open 2 locations during COVID and have been doing well. At the same time, you know, we're not trying to stop there, right? So, you know, what, you know, this is not something that, you know, I would invest so much time and energy and capital into it if I just thought it was going to be 1 or 2 branches, right? You know, if you look at a lot of, you know, business owners who own, you know, restaurants and bars, it, you know, sometimes it's a passion product, right? And, you know, they have 1 location and it's a place for them to enjoy with their networks and, you know, maybe make a little bit of money, but, you know, that might not be the core focus. Where, you know, I think for us, you know, our core focus is, you know, opening 4 or 5 branches in Kenya, opening branches in key markets, like, you know, Uganda, Ethiopia, Congo, and really capturing the benefits of scale, right? You know, so if you have a really strong executive team in terms of a CFO, a CMO, a COO, and a focus on, you know, Pan-African reach, or, you know, maybe even possibly, you know, branches outside the continent, right? You know, if I look at my experiences traveling around the world, you know, I do think this is a concept that will work well in other markets outside Africa as well, where wine penetration might be higher, but at the same time, no one's really, you know, doing a model similar to us in terms of building education and awareness and making it an interactive experience focused on wine. So, you know, there's a lot of different directions that, you know, this business can go to over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you said earlier, you talked about pivoting, you know, there might be a few more pivots for us in the future. So, but, you know, I think, you know, Java is a good model that shows it, you know, if you're able to get, you know, consistency, customer service, and quality, you know, consistent across multiple branches, you know, that's a business you can scale up and really drive down some of your costs and expenses, and have a strong brand that, you know, it attracts people, you know, so that if you're traveling to Naivasha or Biani for the weekend and you want to go out for a drink, you know that there's a WineLife brand, you'll have a certain type of experience. So, you know, at the same time, also looking at, if you look at cities like Naivasha, Nakuru, and Kisumu, you know, tier 2 cities, if you want to call them, in Kenya, a lot of businesses don't target them because they don't think that there's enough of a market there for, you know, the type of investment and cost you would have when you're taking setting up a business. You know, to give you an example, when we were opening our second location at the Yukons, you know, whether it was, you know, the county official who's approving the liquor license and business permit, mm-hmm. to, you know, the landlord who you're paying rent to, you know, to different suppliers and investors that you engage with, you know, there was a lot of question about, you know, why would you open there, right? But at the end of the day, unit economics made a lot of sense, right? So if you look at the business that we have there, you know, the math showed to us that even with 1 to 2 customers every day, you know, we'd be able to cover and get to break even. And, you know, if I look at a typical weekend, at that location, you know, we're engaging with about 100 customers. And, you know, throughout the week, you know, you have your days where there might be no customers or just a couple of customers, but then you have days when, you know, a tourist group stops by there, and they spend the whole afternoon there, right? So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, as a business, you know, you don't need to have, you know, 500 customers coming through your door every single day. But if you really understand the economics and are able to manage them properly, get your marketing right and get your back office right, you know, you can really build a model that scales efficiently. You know, so to set up, you know, 4 or 5 different branches with the same type of concept that we have in Rift Valley in terms of having a converted container, would be cheaper than opening 1 branch in Nairobi. So at the end of the day, you know, there's been opportunities that we've looked at for other locations in Nairobi, but, you know, I'd rather place a bet on opening 5 branches, then one, and having 1 or 2 of those branches not work out, and having 3 other great branches that are just, you know, generating steady cash flow and profit to the business on a monthly basis.
To sort of just calculated diversification.
Exactly. So, you know, it's like playing, you know, roulette at the casino, right? You know, you can bet it all on red or black, or you can, you know, bet on, you know, 7, 9, 13, right? And the return could be quite good, right? So if you hit all of those numbers, you're getting a 36x return as opposed to 2x when you're betting on red or black. Mm. 2x or 0, right? So I think that's kind of the approach that we have in terms of what we're doing on the physical location side. And then there's a lot of interesting stuff that we're doing in terms of partnerships with corporates and events outside of our branches. Because I think another thing that you need to do, especially in this COVID age, is to be flexible as a business and offer your experience outside of your core branches. So one of a few of the things that we've done on that front, I mentioned doing pop-ups at bars as opposed to some of the physical locations there. You know, we've been able to offer virtual wine tastings. You know, we've done virtual wine tastings for companies like McKinsey. Mm-hmm. You know, we've done in-person tastings, you know, for other corporates here. You know, we've been able to do events at some of the prominent golf clubs here. And also recently we've you know, signed an agreement with one of the top banks here to be able to offer this wine-like experience at their events. Right, at their corporate functions, at their golf tournaments, and, you know, offer that experience not just to their clients but to their staff as well. And, you know, we have designed a custom education program specifically for their staff and clients. So you're talking about offering something unique as a bank in terms of customer loyalty and retention to your customers, offering team bonding experience to your staff, and being able to access a large pool of people who are squarely within their target market. And if you look at, you know, whether it's a corporate or a bank, you know, why would you partner on such an initiative with a bar, right? But it's, once again, you know, wine life is, it's more than just a bar, right? And if you look at the type of reach you're trying to have countrywide, you know, banks, you know, have high net worth individuals and employees at all these major cities around the country. So if they wanted to partner with someone who can offer a similar experience to us, there wouldn't be an alternative at the moment, right? So if we're able to build this footprint and open locations in, you know, areas like in Peru and Kisumu and Mombasa, you know, it could be a one-stop shop for, you know, a Kenyan corporate to be able to partner with us as a supplier and a vendor who offer our experiences. Now, when we expand that across the region, you know, when we look at, you know, who are some of these Pan-African corporates, and, you know, what do they want to offer? Do they want to offer offerings to their customer base? Do they want to offer offerings to their staff? You know, wine life can be a go-to to offer, you know, these type of experiences, right? In terms of doing, you know, wine tastings, in terms of hosting corporate functions at our locations. So that's kind of the focus in terms of, you know, if you want to scale, if you want to target a large organization like that and unlock, you know, large amounts of revenue, recurring revenue, consistent revenue, you know, you need to have the scale and reach. So yeah, that's what we're building towards in terms of the retail footprint.
Of course, we've talked about some of the milestones that you've achieved with Wine Life, but then again, pinging back to your experience in Aspira and now Wine Life, what are some of the challenges that you've encountered throughout the journey, and how have you learned to creatively navigate around them?
So, you know, this industry has a reputation for, you know, if you don't have strong systems and processes in the back end, you can get hit for, you know, loss in terms of, you know, in terms of theft, in terms of spoilage, in terms of breakage. You know, so there's a lot of time that we take into making sure that we have the right systems and processes in the back end to really monitor what's coming in and what's going out in terms of our product, in terms of wine, but also in terms of cash and payments as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, you can have a very successful business that has a lot of customers coming in throughout the week, and at the end of the month, you sit there and you say, okay, I didn't make any profit this month, right? So it's a combination of understanding unit economics, but also having your systems and controls in place. I think the other thing that's important in this space is, stakeholder management, right? So, if I look at, companies in the fintech space, it's CBK, it's treasury, right? Whereas in this industry, you're dealing much more directly with the governments, right? In terms of having a proper licensing in place, being sure that, you're serving people of drinking age, things like that. So, stakeholder management is key no matter what industry you're in, but the stakeholders are much different, I would say, in the lifestyle space than in the fintech space. So that's been an adjustment and something that we have had to learn how to navigate.
More on the looking at the stakeholders here, and in this case, regulation. You mentioned that one of the things that you're looking to do at Wine Life is essentially get to the point where you can bring in your own wine, and I believe this is importing.
Yes.
And if you're doing it in Kenya, hey, we have to talk about taxes here.
Yeah.
And from my conversations with various investors, things like taxes are essentially unavoidable. How do you sort of think around that into making sure that your business is regulatory sound, as well as it's making business sense? You're generating the revenues the right way, and you're covering all your overheads, including taxes, as well as preparing for the unpredictability, if you'd rather, of our tax system.
Yeah. So I think if you look at the business of wine, right? There's people who produce and own vineyards. There's people who export and import. There's people who do retail, and then there's people who be at your bars and the hotels. So you look at, as a consumer, you're only interacting with retail or the bars or hotels or whatever that first point of sale is. But there's a whole complicated chain, and this supply chain has been significantly affected, as has most supply chains with COVID, right? So if you look at things like container shortages globally, if you look at restrictions that some countries have had in terms of exporting and importing wine, one thing that I've seen is Kenya is one of the most difficult countries to import alcohol into, just because the amount of checks and quality control that they have in place for starters. But also, if you look at importing anything into Kenya, it's difficult to get a sense of what the cost of importation is, because the tax law is changing quite often, right? You can import a container, and there's a backlog of ships at the port, and every day you're paying additional charges to the ship carrier. If the container hasn't been cleared, you're paying additional charges every day to, now that container is sitting and taking space at the port. Once it's cleared, you have to get these stickers on any bottle that certifies that the duty has been paid for, and then you have to have some of the stored wines, a warehouse. So there's a lot of cost that adds up through that cycle that now gets pushed onto the end user, right? So a lot of people wonder why certain things are more expensive in Kenya than in the US and Europe, right? And at times, if I look at wine, the cost to land a bottle of wine here and clear it can be more expensive in many cases than the retail price of that same bottle of wine in South Africa, France, or US.
Wow.
So a consumer has interacted with that wine in one of those markets, and they come here and they see they're going for twice the price.
They feel ripped off.
They feel ripped off, but at the same time, the price they expected to be sold at is less than what your cost to purchase the wine is, right? So, I think a lot of consumers don't understand that. And it's also difficult to, because of that reason, get wines at certain cost points and quality points here in this market. It's easier to get that into other markets, but it's difficult to get that here. So, you know, for us as a business, you know, I mean, you're also looking at, you know, you're importing a container of wine and 10,000 bottles of wine. You know, you're looking at, you know, an investment of at least $100,000 just to bring you one container. And that container might take 6 months to get here. So that capital is spent up front, and you don't know when that container's going to come, and you have to hope that you'll be able to sell it once it's here. So, you know, for our business model, you know, we haven't started doing that yet at the moment. So essentially, we've outsourced that function to other distributors who have been doing that in this market. Because it doesn't make sense for us in terms of capital perspective, but also in terms of the, you know, what are the core areas we want to focus on as a business, right? So, you know, even when we get to a point when we're looking at importing, you know, is that something we want to partner with an existing distributor, you know, who's figured out and understands that supply chain better than we do? So those are some of the things that we're thinking about and, you know, we'll potentially pivot over time. But at the moment, you know, we haven't started importing, but it's definitely an area that we want to get into in some capacity.
So lastly, I was looking at your previous experiences, and you've worked with Fred Swanika at the Africa Leadership Group,
yeah,
as a chief strategy officer. And one of the things that you used to do there was fundraising. And of course, as a founder in Aspira and now Wine Life, fundraising is something that you definitely have to think about. I understand that currently your two branches are self-funded. Is that right?
Self-funded, but we brought on a bit of outside of investment as well.
How do African, or rather, what would be your recommendation for African founders that are still, you know, navigating, you know, how to raise money to expand their startups?
Yeah. So, you know, I've seen a lot of great businesses in Kenya over my time here. You know, I've invested in a few businesses as well. I would say that, you know, when you interact with a business or a product and you're wowed by the experience, and you look at it and say, yeah, well, this is something that, you know, could scale, or it makes sense. And I can see how this business would be, you know, financially viable in the future. That's one thing. But the second thing is being able now as a founder to articulate that to investors. And I think that's where, you know, you run into challenges, where you wonder why certain businesses are able to raise capital, which might not seem as attractive as other businesses which are struggling to raise even small amounts of capital, right? So, you know, if you look at, Wine Life, for example, it's the type of business that would attract a certain type of investor. You know, probably someone that has had experience investing in this sector, or someone who's, you know, a strategic alignment, right? You know, maybe it's, you know, someone who's owns a vineyard, or someone who runs a wine distribution business, right? So, you know, it's about targeting the right individual, but also the messaging and the story, right? Because, you know, if you're raising, you know, let's say you want to set up, you know, a wine bar and compete with Wine Life in Kenya. The story of, you know, a one branch wine shop, you know, it could be attractive, it could be financially viable, but it's a much different story than, you know, in terms of what we're trying to do with our brand and expand and why we want to expand. You know, we're not expanding just to say, hey, these are locations that are financially viable, but it's about, you know, building a broader presence, you know, for your product and offering. So, you know, that, you know, a lot of investors, you know, ask or look for businesses that are able to scale. And then that's the reason why they look for these types of businesses, right? So if you look at, you know, businesses that aren't able to scale, you know, they're quite limited in terms of their potential and their potential return for investors. So, you know, I think, you know, my advice for founders would be, you know, to understand your business and the types of investors who'd be interested in your business, and being able to articulate to what is the vision and story that you're pitching to them. And then, you know, there's a lot of companies that help with that process, right? Because, you know, if I'm a founder in, you know, the hospitality sector or the fashion sector or, you know, agriculture, my background might not be in terms of, you know, putting together an investment deck or a financial model. But there's resources out there and there's companies that can help, you know, help you clearly articulate your story. Because I've seen a lot of businesses that have great stories and great potential, but, you know, you look at their investor deck or investor memo and it's something that's, you know, a bit scattered and it doesn't really tell the story of what the brand is and what they're trying to do and the accomplishments that they've made so far. So I would say that there's that, and then there's also looking at things that make your, you know, business attractive to an investor, right? So, you know, you can find a lot of people interested in investing in your business, but, you know, how do you value your business? And sometimes that's a very difficult exercise, right? So, you know, for example, one of the things that we're trying to do is lock in a few sources of recurring revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at a business like Wine Lives and what an investor would look at or what an investor would be worried about would be something like recurring revenue, right? And then the importance of recurring revenue is it gives you stability in times that your normal footfall and traffic will be down, right? So a big reason why we've invested in going after strategic partners who could provide us this recurring revenue is that we have a sense of stability and can go to an investor and say, you know, there's X million shillings in recurring revenue that we have as a business on a monthly basis, our overheads are this. So going into a month, we've already covered our overheads with the recurring revenue. So everything else is, in terms of sales is just profit, right? Whereas another business similar to ours, you know, we'll just focus on that regular traffic, which, you know, could be hit by things like tighter restrictions during COVID. If you look at, you know, how to value a business, sometimes there's things that might seem small. You know, let's say there's a business that gives you a recurring revenue of $1,000 a month. But, you know, that goes a long way towards, you know, justifying, you know, what is the valuation of your business. You know, if you have 10 businesses that are giving you, or 10 clients are giving you $1,000 a month in recurring revenue, you know, that's $10,000 that can go towards your overhead to the business. So, you know, looking at the nature of your business and figuring out, you know, what it is that's going to make it attractive from a valuation perspective to investors. It's, you know, having a stream of recurring revenues, it's having feedback in terms of your customers and having done some consumer research. You know, it's have done some type of pilot, even if it's a small scale. You know, if we were looking to raise investment to open a new branch in a new city, what I would do as a first step would be to go and do a couple of pop-up events and just track, you know, the customers who came, the types of revenues and costs that were associated with that pop-up. And, you know, now show that to an investor and project, you know, what the actual financial viability of that location is, right? So, you know, sometimes doing a small, you know, pilot can go a long way in terms of, you know, showing an investor that you've very well done your market research and thought about the cost and expenses associated with, you know, whether it's opening a new branch in our case, but going after a new initiative as a business, right? So about a fintech business and looking to launch a new product, what basis am I using to do that expansion and what is that product? So one thing that we did quite a bit at Aspira is a lot of consumer research before we would actually go into launching a new feature or functionality. And having that comfort, you know, with our existing customer base and potential new clients that this is something that they actually want or need. And then taking a look at now and what the cost would be to actually go live with that, you know, functionality or feature. And, you know, it can be quite simple. It can be something that can be done over a week or a few weeks. But I think a lot of people, you know, try to go out there and raise money having not done enough consumer research or pilots to justify that there is some opportunity in this space. This might be a good idea, but if you haven't done that and shown the investor that you're the right person to be able to, you know, fill this market need and get to that valuation, then it'll be difficult to convince them to, you know, invest at that valuation.
This is actually all I had for today. Is there anything that maybe you'd like to add on?
No, it was a pleasure to speak with you, and hope to host you at future branches, and hopefully maybe one day get back on the podcast once we're on multiple markets and then talk about how that next phase of our journey has been, and you know, how we're able to pull it off.
Looking forward, man. To our listeners, that was Joel Heiler, the founder and CEO of Wine Life. Be sure to check them out on the website. Thank you so much for joining today's discussion. See you next time. Goodbye.